Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Genesis Flood when we come back. Well, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s, and Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it was from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like the flood are strictly ruled out. This process, of course, is called science. Now, listen to this. Physicist Thomas Barnes points out that the Earth's magnetic field had been decaying regularly since it was first measured back in 1835. If the half-life of the magnetic field is truly what Dr. Barnes has shown from careful measurements, the conclusion is this, that the Earth's magnetic field would have to have been equal to that of a magnetic star as little as 10,000 years ago. And according to Dr. Barnes, to be consistent with the laws of physics and assuming the magnetic field has continually weakened, we can only conclude that life on Earth would not have been possible more than 10,000 years ago. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs and their extinction? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? Now, boys and girls, you don't have to be rocket scientists to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And it's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And this is one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here at Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. Remember, it's free of charge. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number's 417-273-4967. And remember, the Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were up to ore bodies. Where do these ore and mineral deposits come from? Is the disaster of Noah's flood a better explanation than the uniformitarian ideology of evolutionary philosophy? Let's see. Now, if petroleum geology has developed essentially independently of historical geology, then this development is even more true of economic geology, which is the study and the development of commercial ore and mineral deposits. Ores of all kinds may be found in rocks of all geologic ages, nearly always associated with igneous intrusions. Thus, historical geology can be of no real value or aid in locating such deposits. Neither is the origin of ore bodies any better understood than the origin of petroleum deposits. There is so much honest difference of opinion among geologists regarding the mode of formation of ore deposits that any attempt at setting forth conclusions regarding the subject is bound to conflict with other opinions. This great difference of opinion is itself the strongest evidence that any sort of consistent uniformitarianism is unsuccessful in accounting for metalliferous deposits or in locating these deposits. The predominant group of theories explains most ore veins as originating in cooling magmas, which have intruded themselves into the strata with gaseous or aqueous solutions, carrying the metals upward through fissures or pipes until they are precipitated out in ore form. But as von Engelen and Castor have pointed out, this concept encounters some very serious problems. The awkward thing to explain about the mechanics of vein formation is how there can be at one and the same time a passageway for the ascending solutions in a fissure completely filled and even enlarged by the minerals that the solutions deposit. As far as is known, nothing of this sort has been observed to happen in the present era or even in the Pleistocene era. The formation of ore deposits is seemingly a phenomenon that occurred at some time in the past, independently of the particular geological stratum, and by means of agencies which are not understood now, but which most likely were catastrophic in character, associated with volcanism. So here we have catastrophe. You know, catastrophe is the antithesis of uniformitarianism. But you know, the uniformitarians all believe in catastrophe. Did you know that? Think about it. How did the universe originate? It was through a gigantic explosion. It was this gigantic blast which blew everything out into space that we see today. Now, isn't that a disaster? Isn't that a one-in-a-lifetime violent explosion of mass and matter? Now, of course, that isn't what God told us in the Bible was the real origin of mass and matter or the origin of the universe, but that's what they tell us, and I'm just repeating their story. That's the story that they print and put out here and disseminate. And so, every day in this series, I've come on the air and I've given you one example after another of just do the arithmetic. And you can see that we're dealing with philosophy, not science. It goes under the guise of science. Now, when they try to explain, well, where does gold come from? Well, it comes from igneous rock, that is hot molten rock. Okay. Now, you remember, you got these continents rising up and down, over hundreds of millions and billions of years, and that's how these sediments, these stratas, are developed. All right, now, when did the gold veins and silver veins and the copper ore veins get deposited in this? See, it doesn't come out. It doesn't jibe. It doesn't make sense. There had to be some kind of an intrusion up through those rocks, because that's what we find. These ore bodies are in all kinds of rocks. It isn't just in Jurassic rocks or Mississippian rocks or Cretaceous rocks or some other kind of rock. It's in all of them. And it was forced into those rocks. There's some kind of a catastrophe occurred here. Now, if we go back to Noah's flood, that's precisely what God said. He said the fountains of the great deep were broken up. There was a disaster. And out of that disaster came volcanoes. Evidently, prior to the flood, there were no volcanoes. There were no earthquakes. The earth was sitting on a ball bearing. The crust of the earth was cushioned by a water underneath it that insulated it from the inner core of the earth. When the great deep was broken up, the water spewed out, the crust collapsed into the void where the water was and is no more, and this opened up fissures down into the earth's interior, which we see to this day in the form of volcanoes and earthquakes. The results of, or the aftermath of, the great flood are still with us to this day. Still with us. Now, where did the gold and the silver and the copper? It was down underneath that mantle, and it has been extruded out. And it is right now today in these ore bodies and veins. That's what we see. That's the physical evidence. Now he goes on and he says, mineralization is not a rare phenomenon, nor a vagary of nature, as is sometimes assumed, but is instead a common geological process almost invariably accompanying volcanic activity as a final phase thereof. While it is probably an attendant feature of most igneous intrusions within the uppermost 4 miles of the Earth's crust. Now, although ore formation is little understood and uniformitarian approaches to its understanding have proved mostly sterile, it would seem that its universality in both geographic location and supposed geologic time, its almost invariable association with igneous activity, and its apparently catastrophic manner of deposition are most easily visualized in our basic deluge framework. During the flood, as we have seen, volcanic activity of all sorts continued globally during most of the flood period, and therefore volcanic rocks are now found throughout the world and throughout the geologic column. Formation of mineral deposits of great extent and variety was undoubtedly possible during the flood and can best be understood in this context. Of course, the very extensive Precambrian ores may well be attributed to the creation period itself in many cases. And although there is much yet to be learned about the Earth's great oil and mineral deposits, it is surely obvious that the evolutionary concept of historical geology is of very little practical utility in their discovery and exploitation, such as is known about the character of these deposits and their formations, fits equally well or even better into the framework of biblical geology. And it simply is incorrect to assert that such processes and such success as has been attained by the disciplines of petroleum and economic geology is evidence of the validity of orthodox historical geology, because it simply is not. Now, what's the modern significance of the Genesis flood? We have obviously not attempted to solve all of the difficulties that may be encountered in our proposed biblical reorientation of historical geology. However, we have made a serious attempt to select the most difficult problems for treatment, and it is hoped that even these have been shown to be amenable to satisfactory explanation in terms of biblical geology. And there is a total bankruptcy of uniformitarianism. The present widely accepted system of uniformitarianism and historical geology, with its evolutionary basis and bias, has been shown to be totally inadequate to explain most of the important geologic phenomena. Present rates and processes simply cannot account for the great bulk of the geologic data that we observe today. Some form of catastrophism is clearly indicated by the vast evidences of volcanism, disastrophism, glaciation, coal and oil and mineral deposits, fossilization, vast beds of sediments, and most of the other dominant features that we observe in the Earth's crust. And when this fact is once recognized, it can then be seen that even the supposed evidences of great geologic age can be reinterpreted to correlate well with the much more impelling evidences of violent and rapid activity and formation. But if present processes cannot be used to deduce the Earth's past history, and this fact is proved not only by the failure of geological uniformity, but even more by the impregnable laws of conservation and deterioration of energy, entropy, then the only way man can have certain knowledge of the nature of events on Earth prior to the time of the beginning of human historical records is by means of revelation. And this is why the Bible record of creation and the flood immediately becomes tremendously pertinent to our understanding, not only of the early history of the earth, but also of the purpose and the destiny of the universe and of mankind. We have therefore sought to show how the outline of Earth history provided by the early chapters of Genesis, as well by the related passages from other parts of the Bible, actually provides a scientifically accurate framework within which all of the verified data of geology and geophysics fit together remarkably well. The great deluge of Noah's day is seen to account for a large portion of the sedimentary rocks of the Earth's crust, and indirectly for the glacial and other surface deposits, which resulted from the change in the Earth's climate at the time of the flood. Now the reader may judge for himself whether the evidence truly warrants this reorientation of geological philosophy. We hope it does. And we hope, of course, that he will really consider the evidence and not be disposed to reject it strictly on the basis of the fact that authorities may not approve. But many may thoughtlessly wonder, what difference does it make whether or not the flood was really a global flood, or whether it actually produced many of our present rock strata, or whether indeed the world and its inhabitants came about by a process of evolution or not. Even many Christians allege that these are unimportant questions, that they do not affect Christian faith one way or the other. However, these are not mere academic questions, and though it may be possible for the careless to treat them as such, a little serious consideration should show that they are profoundly important, and that one's convictions about them may have deep influence upon his whole philosophy of life, and therefore perhaps even on his ultimate destiny. Now, we have seen two basic philosophies, and there are really only two basic philosophies or religions among mankind. The one is oriented primarily with respect to God, or a God, the Creator, of whom and by whom and for whom are all things made. Man is a creature of God, and among the highest of his creatures, but nevertheless totally dependent upon and responsible to him, the Creator. Man's disobedience to his Creator has resulted in universal loss of fellowship with God, and this condition manifests itself in all forms of sin, commonly known as crime, and in pain and death, even being reflected in the inharmonious relationships in the rest of the animate and inanimate creation. Salvation from this lost condition of man and his world has required the direct intervention of God himself in the form of a man in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, whose atoning death on the cross of Calvary was the terrible price of redemption. But with the full price of redemption and regeneration and restoration thus provided by God through Christ, salvation then becomes available freely to all men to be received by grace through faith entirely apart from man's works. This, of course, is the essence of Christianity, or at least biblical Christianity. Now, the other basic philosophy is oriented primarily with respect to man. This system appearing in an almost infinite variety of forms. It supposes that man is inherently capable of acquiring by his own efforts all of the needs in this present life and in any possible life to come. The emphasis is always on man's own works or his reason or his religious duties or something else that man does to bring about his own improvement and ultimate salvation. Any idea of God is perhaps accommodated somewhere in the system, but always as a being more or less limited in his activities or decisions. This God is often conceived primarily in pantheistic terms, essentially identical with the universe and even with man himself as the highest entity thus far evolved. And the underlying dynamic of this philosophy is the concept of evolution, the idea of development, of growth, of process and progress, of improvement, appeals to man's pride and ambition, and so finds abundant manifestation in all of the many religious and philosophic systems of man, be these ancient idolatries or primitive animism or modern existentialism or atheistic communism. All of these center around man and the works of man, as do all other religions except biblical Christianity. The idea of evolution did not originate with Charles Darwin by any means. Men have always conceived in some way or another the idea that man's identification with nature and man's dependence upon nature for his own existence. Whatever gods there be have also been visualized as arising or evolving out of some sort of primeval stuff or chaos. In early cosmologies, this concept seems sometimes connected also with the competing concept of a divine creator, indicating even in those times a conflict between the two fundamental systems existed. Now, in our modern day, we have a thing called theistic evolution. The prominent historian of science, Dr. Charles Gillespie of Princeton, remarks concerning the philosophy of Lamarck, one of the evolutionary predecessors of Charles Darwin. M. de Lamarck was the last representative of that great school of naturalists and general observers who held sway from Thales and Democritus right down to Buffon. He was the mortal enemy of the chemists, of experimentalists, of petty analysts, as he called them. No less severe was his philosophical hostility, amounting to hatred for the tradition of the deluge and the biblical creation story. Indeed, for everything which recalled the Christian theory of nature. And, of course, all of the prominent founders of the modern theory of evolution, that is Darwin, Huxley, Spencer, Haeckel, and others, were firm opponents of the entire biblical view of the world and of man. By and large, this is also true today of the present leaders of the evolutionary thought. And although it is true that there are many people who have tried to harmonize evolution and Christianity in their own personal philosophies, but the light esteem in which such a concept as theistic evolution is held by the real leaders of evolutionary philosophy and research is indicated by the following from the geneticist Goldschmidt. Now keep in mind this concept of harmonizing evolution and the Bible. It's rejected by the scientists. And it's rejected by those that subscribe to and believe in the Bible. Now, those that don't believe in the Bible, don't read the Bible, don't care about it one way or the other, they may have philosophies and ideas, but the philosophies and ideas don't square with the facts of Scripture. Let's see. In the evolutionary pattern of thought, there's no longer need or room for the supernatural. That's what Julian Huxley said. No need for the supernatural. The earth was not created, it evolved. So did all of the animals and plants that inhabit it, including our human selves, mind and soul, as well as the brain and body. So did religion. There isn't any room in Julian Huxley's philosophy for any accommodation with the Bible. Another type of evolutionary theory hardly deserves to be mentioned, said Goldschmidt in a scientific paper. There is a mystical approach which hides its insufficient understanding of the facts behind such empty words as creative evolution, emergent evolution, holism, and psycho-Lamarckism. The biologist does not receive any constructive help from such ideas and is forced to ignore them. Only the empty pulpit parrots come up with the idea that there is some kind of common ground between evolution and creation, or evolution and the Bible. The Bible has no room for evolution, and the evolutionists have no room for the Bible. Now, in addition to genetics, the other science which has been most directly concerned with evolution is that of paleontology, which has, in fact, provided the one genuine class of evidence that evolution, on any large scale, may actually have occurred through its study of the fossils. One of the world's outstanding paleontologists, Dr. George Simpson of Harvard University, delivers himself on the subject of these theistic theories of evolution as follows. He said, "The fossil record definitely does not accord with the concept of orthogenesis, or more broadly, with overtly or covertly non-materialistic theories like those of Dresch, Bergson, Osborne, Chenault, Dunoy, or Vandal. And this opinion, written 10 years ago, is now held apparently more emphatically than ever before by Simpson in an important address given in connection with the Darwinian Continental Convocation and the annual meeting of the American Association for Advancement of Science at the University of Chicago." Simpson went on to say, "Evolution is a fully natural process inherent in the physical properties of the universe, by which life arose in the first place and by which all living things, past or present, have since developed divergently and progressively. Organisms diversified into literally millions of species, and then the vast majority of those species perish and other millions take their place for an eon until they do are replaced. And if that is a foreordained plan, it is an oddly ineffective one. A world in which man must rely upon himself, in which he is not the darling of the gods, but only another, albeit extraordinary, aspect of nature, is by no means congenial to the immature or the wishful thinkers. Life may be conceivably be happier for some people in the other worlds of superstition. It is possible that some children are made happy by a belief in Santa Claus, but adults should prefer to live in a world of reality and reason." Well, I couldn't agree with that more. You see, what they're saying is that we don't have any room for the pulpit parrots either. Here's what the real gist of the conflict is all about. The religious guys cannot explain the flood. They cannot explain science and the flood. So they come up with religious ideas, crazy ideas that are unscientific. For instance, do you remember this one? The world is flat. That came from religion. Or the sun revolves around the earth. Remember that one? That comes from religion. Then, when men of reason discovered that these two facts, I mean, it's a fact that the world is either round or it's flat. It's a fact that either the earth orbits the sun or the sun orbits the earth. When men of reason found these facts and confronted religion, and said, "Why did you tell us the earth was flat? The Bible, boys and girls, plainly tells us that the earth is round." Religion said, "No, God made a mistake. The world's flat. Is it any wonder, then, that people that are not totally brain dead reject the Bible because they're really rejecting religion? And they connect religion with the Bible. And the two are about as far removed as evolution and creation. That's the real gist of our problem. The religious guys do not believe in the Bible any more than the atheistic guys do. It's just that the atheistic guys are not hypocrites. They don't run around with a Bible under their arms like Bill Clinton coming out of church. They don't go to church. They don't waste their time on it. They're not hypocrites. It's the religious guys that are the hypocrites. They hold up the Bible and say, well, we follow God. They don't practice the Sabbath. They don't practice the holy days. If you take a look at the 133 titles or subjects of law in the Bible, here in America, we practice 51 of those laws, or at least we give lip service to 51, and we violate 82, and we absolutely repudiate and reject those laws. Now, 65% of Americans go to church. 65% of Americans are religious. 65% of Americans not only go to church, they go to church every Sunday. And probably half of those go to church on Wednesday. And they reject the Bible just as much as do the atheists and the alleged scientists. At least the philosophers. Hang on. Let me give you a reminder. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed at georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Again, the webpage, georgegordon.org, the telephone number 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Genesis flood. Let me give you a reminder here. The Genesis flood, you can probably buy paperback for $10 or $15. Just go to Amazon.com or go to Barnes & Noble or somebody like that. You're looking for the Genesis flood. That's the title. It's written by two authors, Whitcomb, W-H-I-T. It is W-H-I-T-C-O-M-B. And Henry M. Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S. Both of them have letters after their names, so you know they're smart. Right now we're talking about the problems of biblical geology, and in particular, theistic evolution. Goldschmidt and Huxley have totally rejected any concept that there can be any common ground between the Bible and God and evolution. Remember what Huxley said? He said in the evolutionary pattern of thought, there is no longer need or room for the supernatural. The earth was not created. It evolved. So did all of the animals and plants that inhabit it, including our human selves, mind and soul, as well as brain and body. And so did religion. He kind of holds religion up to contempt. And rightfully so. Religionists are a petty bag of conflicting, arguing, and fighting people who are trying to gain more proselytes so that they can make more money. Religion is a business. And it's a scam. And it is sold as a business. It's protected under the First Amendment. It's protected criminal activity. Just take a look at this guy, Jim Baker. You know, the guy that was lying, stealing, and cheating from old ladies and widows that were sending him $100 million a year. And that, remember this guy, there's another one down there who was screwing whores all the time. What was his name? Down in the South. I'll think of his name here in a minute. Guy came on TV, tears streaming down his face, and said, "Oh God, I've sinned against you." You know, if a guy went out to Flo's Whorehouse and tore off a piece on Friday night, we could all see that, well, you know, maybe the guy was tempted a little bit and comes back and says, "Mary, I'm really sorry I did that. Would you please forgive me?" You know, I think most of us could grasp that. But then when the guy goes down to Flo's the following week and he goes and goes and goes, there isn't any repentance there. The guy's not sorry for what he's doing. He's sorry he got caught. And that's why we have so little respect for religion or religionists. They're hypocrites. Just like Bill Clinton walking out of church with a Bible under his arm while he's screwing that woman under his desk. I mean, come on, guys. A truck driver goes into a lot lizard and tears off a little in the parking lot, but he ain't walking out of church with a Bible under his arm and saying, "Oh, God, forgive me because I have sinned." You know, at least a longshoreman, you know, when he's out doing a little on Friday night and he's getting drunk and having a good time, he's not a hypocrite about it. The Bible has something to say about these religious hypocrites. If I had a Bible here in front of me, I'd read it to you, but and where is it? I don't have one right in front of me, but it's in Matthew. Jot this down, boys and girls. It's in Matthew 7, verses 21, 22, 23, along in there. Oh yeah, here it is right here. Let me pull this out here. Let me read this to you. You gotta hand it to Huxley and these evolutionists. At least they're not hypocrites. At least the guys are telling you, "Hey, listen, we don't have any use for religion. We don't believe in it. We don't think it's got any merit." The guys that are trying to spread that evolutionary crap in the churches are the pulpit parrots over there that don't have an answer. They can't explain the book of Job. They don't understand Noah's flood. They don't understand evolution, and they don't understand the Bible, and they don't understand creation. And so they're over here saying, "Well, how can we keep all of our parishioners happy?" Oh, I know. We'll just kind of meld the two. God created the world through evolution. Now go read Genesis 1 and 2 and see if that's the conclusion you can come to. Listen to this. Here in Matthew 7, verses 21, 22, and 23. Here's God himself. He says, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? And in your name have cast out devils? And in your name have done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity." He called these religious jerks hypocrites, whitened sepulchers. Jesus never had a good word for a preacher, a banker, or a lawyer. And if you can find one good word for a preacher, banker, or lawyer from the mouth of Jesus or from the mouth of Moses or God or anybody else, send me an email and let me know. I'd like to see that. That'd be a real revelation, you know that? Now, probably the most significant thing about these remarks of Simpson, Huxley, and many others that were to the same effect at this significant Darwinian worship service was that evidently none of the more than 2,000 leading scientists that were present from all over the world raised any public objections to these sentiments. The general commitment of the world intellectual community today to this type of philosophy is well known to all who are at all conversant with modern scientific literature. Only the religious pulpit parrots are spreading this concept of theistic evolution. The evolutionists totally reject it. And anybody that reads or believes in the scripture would totally reject it. Now the rest of the religious people can probably accept it. Now let's take a look at evolution, communism, and humanism. In this country, with its Christian culture and traditions, true atheistic evolution has never been able to gain any great following, even among scientists. Although it is certainly true that a large majority of the leaders in biology, paleontology, and other such fields, even in this country, have completely rejected true biblical Christianity in favor of the evolutionary view of the world. In other countries, the real implications of evolution have been more readily recognized and acknowledged, and this is especially true in communist countries, where it is the backbone of the whole scientific structure of communistic philosophy. The outstanding biologist and geneticist, his name is Dobzhansky, who formerly lived in Russia. Here's what he said. He said, Marx recommended rather different methods, which he believed to be somehow deducible from Darwin's discoveries. He proposed to acknowledge his indebtedness by dedicating Das Kapital to Darwin, an honor which Darwin politely declined. Well, the famous funeral oration over the body of Karl Marx delivered by Engels stressed the evolutionary implications of communism. And he said, just as Darwin discovered the law of evolution in organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of evolution in human history. And although communism is the most dangerous and widespread philosophy opposing Christianity today, there are many others. And the significant thing is that all of them are basically man-centered with some form of evolutionary philosophy undergirding them. And such a man-centered evolutionary philosophy is becoming ever more powerful all over the world in every area of life. This viewpoint dominates the United Nations organization and all of the various One World movements. Its thesis is succinctly stated by Dr. H. J. Muller as follows. Muller said, the foregoing conclusions represent, I believe, an outgrowth of the thesis of modern humanism, as well as the study of evolution, that the primary job for man is to promote his own welfare and advancement, both that of his members considered individually and that of the all-inclusive group, in due awareness of the world as it is and on the basis of a naturalistic scientific ethics. Naturalistic scientific ethics. Leave God out of the picture. We don't need any of those. Now, mankind has been pretty religious throughout most of his history. You go back into ancient times and you find that the Babylonians, Egyptians, and the Sumerians, the Greeks, and the Romans, and all these ancient peoples were religious. And they always had science and religion melded together. Nothing's changed. Today, we have science and religion melded together. And we call it theistic evolution, humanism, and communism. We want to be religious communists. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you get right down to the bottom line, there's no common ground between communism, humanism, and the Bible. There might be between communism and humanism and Christianity, or Mohammedism or Buddhism or some other religious ideologies out there. People seem to want to do both. You find communists that go to church. Sounds kind of bizarre, you know. Sounds kind of crazy. You find scientists, they go to church. Not entirely clear why. If there is a God, did he lie to us in the scripture? If there is a God, does his word mean anything? I mean, if he says, sit down and shut up, does that mean anything? Or do you just give him the finger and say, kiss off, punk. Get out of my life. Because as an observer of human beings and human natures, as an educator, you know, I sit here and I watch people all the time. And I'm often bemused by the contradictory beliefs and actions that they take in their lives. What they say they believe and what they practice of those beliefs are totally at opposition to one another. I see people that go to church, but they don't obey anything that comes out of the Bible. For instance, in Leviticus 19:19, it says not to wear clothes of mixed fabrics. People don't think anything about going in and buying a shirt that's 45% cotton, 25% something else, and 30% something else. Nobody actually practices the laws of the Bible. You know, in Leviticus 23, God said, these are my holy days. These are the days I want you to observe. People don't observe those holy days. They practice Christmas, Easter, and New Year's, and the 4th of July, and May Day. They don't practice Leviticus 23. God, that's crazy. But so it is. And that's exactly what we see here in the Genesis flood. That what you're looking at here is you've got science on the one hand and religion on the other. And here are the religious guys trying to make peace with the evolutionists. And they claim to follow the Bible? Well, the God of the Bible doesn't have any room for these vain philosophers. Let me tell you a little story here. The Apostle Paul over in Romans chapter 1 had something to say about vain philosophies and perverts and such like. Let me just flip over here to Romans chapter 1. Listen to this. This ought to frost you. Starting over here in verse 18, he says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, or hold back the truth in unrighteousness, as it should read. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. They're dumb on purpose. That's a line came right out of Kent Hovind. He said, these philosophers are dumb on purpose. God, I wished I'd have thought of that line. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, and neither were they thankful, but they became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Why, they go to college and they get letters after their names, and they put plaques and papers up on their walls proclaiming to the world how smart these guys are. You see it every time you walk into a lawyer's office or a doctor's office or some professional's office. He's got all of his smarts up there on the wall. Military people do it, but they wear theirs on their chest. All of their life's accomplishments. I mean, if I could read all of those letters and medals, if I knew what any of them meant, which I don't, because I don't know how brave and how smart these people are. But soldiers wear it right on their chest. And professional people print it and put it right up on their walls. Look how smart I am. Look at my degree. Look at my doctor. Look at my papers. Well, you can see how dumb I am. I don't have any papers and I don't have any ribbons and medals either. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, God told them. He said, and they changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. And for this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, and even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. Those are called queers in common language. Out on the docks. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense for their error which was meet. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. Do you get that? They don't like to retain God in their knowledge. They want to reject God. And so they have, from the educational institutions of America. Threw him out of our public lives and public offices and our public affairs. And then profess themselves to be wise? Surely we got to be kidding ourselves over here, boys and girls. And then in verse 29, he says, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, deceit, debate, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things. What do you think an atomic bomb is? Inventors of evil things, weapons of mass destruction, disobedient to parents. Disobedient to parents. If you'd have lived back in my day when I was a little kid, nobody was disobedient to his parents. The reason I know that, because they were all survivors. Everybody that was disobedient to his parents got killed. I never heard of such a thing. Never heard of such a thing. Never saw it. It never entered my mind. Because if it had entered my mind and had it come to fruition, my daddy or my granddaddy would have slapped me up alongside the head, bounced me off the wall, beat the living hell out of me, and then kicked me in the ass and set me down in a chair, as my old granddad used to say. It's time for you to come back down to earth, son. You're floating around out in ether somewhere. Now take a look at today. Why these punks run around today with earrings in their ears, bragging to everybody that they're bond servants. You know, if they knew and understood what a hole in a man's ear is, they ought to be ashamed of themselves. I was watching 60 Minutes the other day. Remember this guy, Ed Bradley, on there? He's got an earring in his ear. These blacks, you know, they like to be kind of modern and up-to-date and decrying slavery. That's the very essence of slavery, is to have a hole bored through your ear. It's called bond servitude. It's a social status created by God. It's a shame for a man to have a hole bored in his ear. People today run around with these holes and earrings in their ears like it's some kind of a great mark of accomplishment. Without any understanding, verse 31. Without understanding. They don't understand what the hell that hole in the ear means. Covenant breakers. When I was a kid, you could make a contract with a guy with a handshake. Today you gotta have a notary seal it, write it up, and file it with the county recorder. And even then, the SOB will violate the terms of the contract and cheat you if he can. And that's what all insurance companies do. Just take a look at what's going on down here on the Gulf Coast. They went down there and sold insurance to thousands and thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people down there. Then when this Hurricane Katrina comes in, they said, yeah, we pay for hurricanes, but not water damage. Got that? Fortunately, there's a lawyer going down there. He's going to bring a class action suit. He's got some credentials, too. He's won some multi-billion dollar settlements in tobacco and asbestos. Maybe he can go down there and shape up those insurance companies. Talk about a fraud. Talk about a theft. talk about covenant breakers, the insurance industry of America, covenant breakers. He says they're without natural affection, they're implacable, they're unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. Hell, they do it, and they revel in it. So there's what God has to say about these philosophers, these Charles Darwins and the scientific philosophers, you know, that say, well, we don't believe in God. Evolution and education comes into the picture. Evolution in our education has destroyed the moral fiber of the nation. You know, back in the 30s, people were pretty moral. They might have been poor. They were really having a tough time of it. But they weren't out raping, robbing, and pillaging on the streets and rioting. You wait until this economy collapses, and then you watch the anarchy that goes on in Detroit. It'll start in Detroit. Mark my word. The people are going to come unhinged. Unhinged. They will burn everything in sight. The president will call out the troops. There will be martial law in imposed. See, Americans today do not have the kind of moral character that we had back in the 1930s. We can't restrain ourselves, as evidenced by the excesses in our life here in America. Everything is done to excess. Excesses in sex, excesses in education and schools, and excesses in sports, excesses in finance and economics. There's never enough. We've got to have more and more and more. You can see that in the colleges. These kids, you know, they go out there and they raise hell, and then the next year they got to raise more hell, and the following year they got to raise more hell, until the educational experience in America has nothing to do with education. It has everything to do with party, having fun, excesses. It's a hedonistic society. This is not the America of 1900 or 1850 or 1787. And our forefathers, if they could see what's going on here today, would turn over in their graves. It would sicken them all to see the degeneration that's gone on in this country. And I would suspect that it's gone on or is going on in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Western Europe. And there is an obvious end to this. There's a fruition. Remember, the name of the book now is called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. And it'll give you a basic understanding. Remember, Whitcomb and Morris made this observation in there. It said that it will affect your lifestyle. It will affect your outlook on life. Now, if you don't want to change your outlook on life, you certainly don't want to read a book like this. But if you're not afraid of truth, understanding, wisdom, understanding, etc., Whitcomb and Morris, called The Genesis Flood. And we'll be back with the concluding chapter to this story here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. All right, let me give you a final reminder. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.